This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lamber and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the week's top stories that they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And we're 1 week on from this.
We have a president-elect, and that is the billionaire from New York, who has never held public office in his life.
Just how has the world reacted to a Trump victory, and what can we expect looking forward?
Our expectation is that we will continue to see positive performance by the equity markets around the world, but led by the US.
And Simon informs me he has read Donald Trump's entire economic plan. I'm not sure what he did for the rest of the 5 minutes. Closer to home, the rumours, the leaks, the predictions. I'm talking Autumn Statement 2016. What is on the cards? Will Philip Hammond stick to his commitment to help the so-called jams, or will he find the money spread too thin?
My hunch is that Hammond won't want to increase spending that much in the end, and he won't want to start off his term as Chancellor being seen as a bit of a giveaway merchant.
Well, what has he got to play with? We got some key figures out this week. Shopping up, unemployment down, inflation down a smidge. But for how long?
Inflation is going to head for about 3% over the next year or so. The good news, though, is that that should be a temporary blip.
Well, with the current economic environment, is there any safe haven left for cash savings?
Less than half of savings accounts now beat or match inflation. And that's because the number of accounts that have been cut recently is outstanding.
But what about the lifetime ISA? It comes in next year, but there are growing fears young people may lose out to mis-selling or indeed their own financial or lack of knowledge. The woes of youth, though, don't stop there, continuing to bear the brunt of the housing crisis.
Almost 60% of people in that age group in 2003 owned their own home, and that has now fallen to 37%.
It's OK, you can cheer yourself up, though, with a cup of coffee. Perhaps not, though, if you live in London. And with Christmas around the corner, why not treat your loved one to a his and her matching white Ferrari, the ultimate accessory for, what, do you know, I've actually no idea, a footballer perhaps? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rachel.
Good morning. Good morning.
I want to know, please, what would the ultimate luxury item be for you from a loved one? From a loved one, from anybody.
But the loved one would need enough money to be able to buy said luxury item, or can we imagine that the loved one has an unlimited pot?
Unlimited.
Okay, so in this thought experiment, I'd like a ski chalet, please.
No, that doesn't count.
Why doesn't that count?
No, that's property, that doesn't count. It needs to be an item, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, do you know what I think? Rachel, what do you reckon? Ski chalet?
Give him a ski chalet.
All right, you can have a ski chalet.
Can I have a car?
If I'm not allowed
a ski chalet, can I have a car?
You can have a car. Well, I was expecting you to say a car.
Okay. Do you know what? I would at some point in my life like to own a Ferrari.
Okay.
I would like a Ferrari.
A white one?
Not a white one.
A matching his and her one?
No. And actually, in this instance, the matching his and hers, the other one is a McLaren. So it's a Ferrari and a McLaren. It's his and hers supercars. I wouldn't have a white one. I think you've got to go red with a Ferrari.
What about your ski chalet?
I wouldn't have that in red. No. I'd like that with lots of white on the roof.
Rachel, for you, his and hers, anything? Or just a hers?
No, thanks.
No. Luxury item?
No, I actually can't think of anything I want. Maybe a luxury cat. I'd quite like a cat. And I wouldn't mind a Burmese one. I know that's naughty. I know I should go down to Bassey Dog's home. But we've had Burmese cats before and they're so talkative and lively and playful.
Talkative? The cat?
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, they have variations on a meow that I haven't seen in other cats. That sound as if they're speaking more. They're more sort of expressive. But apart from that, no. Thank you.
This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year. This is Money, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. Joined today by editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Can't speak. Anyway, coming up, the rumours, the leaks, the predictions, Autumn Statement 2016. What does the new Chancellor have in store in the wake of the Brexit vote? But before we look forward, let's just take a little look back as the dust starts to settle on that other big bombshell of 2016.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time.
We will make America great again.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
We're going to have a border. It's going to be a real border, and we're going to build a wall.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Yeah, he will be soon. So how is the world, the markets, reacting to that Trump victory? And what can we expect when the billionaire businessman actually moves in those big gold chairs into the Oval Office? Even the chair of the, much criticised by Mr. Trump, I should point out, Fed, Janet Yellen, admitted they don't actually know what will happen when she spoke this week. Here's CEO of Investor, Karim Dirali.
The first thing he said he's going to do is he's going to cut corporation tax, which is rather uncompetitive at the moment, by 20% down to 15%. That's going to be obviously fantastic for companies. Tax burden is going to reduce on them, and that should be a big stimulus for their activities. The second thing that he wants to do is that he wants to encourage US companies to repatriate some of the trillions of dollars of cash that they're holding overseas back to the US by offering them a tax holiday of just a tax amnesty or holiday of 10%. To encourage them to bring that money back into the US. And that's going to be very, very good for the US economy and also possibly for the dollar. And the third thing that he said he's going to do is he wants to invest $1 trillion, and that's a lot of money in anyone's language. He wants to invest $1 trillion in infrastructure in the US. That's rebuilding some of the roads and bridges that have been decaying for some period of time. So when you take all of these things together, that's going to be a tremendous boost to the US economy. And it means that the economic policy, which has been relying very, very much on the Federal Reserve and the cheap money and the free, almost free money that has been given out, is going to get a big boost from government spending.
Well, despite fears of a Trump again, markets have rallied with a Trump bump, but then there's Trumpflation on the cards. Anyway, do you remember a wee while back, Simon and Rachel, on the show when, I think it was about a week or so after the Brexit vote. Now, I dared to suggest that the dust was settling on that vote. And a listener quite rightly pointed out that you could still see said dust from space. So can I say it now? Or do we still have absolutely no idea just how has the world responded to a President Trump?
Well, initially with a mix of sort of shock and incredulity, in a sort of like, if you think about it for longer than a, you know, few seconds, you think, how on earth did Donald Trump end up becoming US president-elect? That's not normal. As John Oliver kept banging on about the other day on his show, in which I recommend people watching. But it's not a normal situation, OK? This was not a normal election. The things that were done to get elected, the things that were said were not normal. We are not in a normal situation. The Simpsons famously, you know, highlighted this as the most preposterous potential for the president in the future. And now it's actually happened. And then we've seen Trump turn around and be slightly different to the Trump that we saw during the election campaign, and a lot more considered, and look like he's kind of changing his mind on a few things as well. And if there is one thing we know about Donald Trump, there's a very good chance that he may change his mind on any number of things. And he's not actually going to be the president until January. So that leaves quite a lot of time. But we've also started to see some appointments to his sort of transition council, and then some other appointments that people have been slightly concerned about, members of the family, a guy called Steve Bannon, who's very big in this alt-right movement and Breitbart News. But what's happened in the financial world is the Trumpflation trade is on.
The Trumpflation trade.
Yeah. Basically, traders like a trade, and they like a trade that they can give a name to.
Right.
And the Trumpflation trade is the one they like at the moment. The idea is, Trump has said that he's going to spend a load of money.
Building a wall
on infrastructure.
Stuff, yeah.
Well, I think he's going to get someone else to pay for the wall, apparently.
But, yeah, that's
but
true.
He has infrastructure. So, as I said, and as you alluded to, I have actually read Donald Trump's economic plan on his website.
How was that?
Longer than you think.
Okay.
Bullet points, you know, hopeful.
Has one, though.
Hopeful.
That's,
it's hopeful. Also his infrastructure plan as well,
right,
which is the big thing that people are talking about. Now, the infrastructure plan is interesting because basically Donald Trump's not actually talking about necessarily spending any money on this infrastructure. What he's going to do is deliver a huge amount of infrastructure spending via some tax credits. He reckons he can fill a $226 billion gap in infrastructure investment over 10 years with $8 billion of tax credits. This is a plan based on a National Association of Manufacturers report. He says that will be deficit neutral, so it won't cost the country money in terms of its deficit, but that's possibly because the economic benefit of doing all this infrastructure will get more money flowing in the economy and spending and lead to more tax revenue and things like that. So there's the infrastructure plan. But if he does do this, if they do go out and do this, it's debatable as to how successful this tax credit thing and all these other things would be. But it will be a change in direction to actually going out, spending some money on infrastructure. And he's talking about things that could actually benefit the economy. Roads, bridges, energy and things like that. The other thing that he's talking about doing is tearing up a load of regulation. Many regulations that have been put in place to try and make the world a better place, such as environmental regulation. He's not so hot on environmental regulation. Some of the stuff to do with the banks. He also wants to give people a big tax cut. So he wants to cut corporation tax from 35% to 15%. Sounds like an immense cut, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But what you have to remember is that American corporation tax is very high. Ours is 20% over here. And also ridiculously complicated. So you have all of these companies that don't ever end up actually paying this rate of tax, or they end up doing what a lot of the tech giants are doing and holding these huge sums of money offshore that they don't want to repatriate because they don't want to pay the tax on it. Now, he actively wants to get them to bring this money back into the country and is saying to them, you can pay less tax on it, bring the money back. He also wants to cut people's taxes, so take low earners out of income tax, similar to what we've done over here. Income tax rates are 12%, 25%, 33%. Basically, this would be what is called fiscal easing, a massive fiscal program, tax cuts, government spending. And the idea would be that basically, if you do all of this, you're going to get inflation. So hence the Trumpflation. So what people have been doing is dumping bonds, because if you've got bonds with low yields on them, and bear in mind, government bonds have been yielding ridiculously low amounts.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got inflation, that's going to eat into those already low returns in the future. And also, if you think you're going to have inflation, it means interest rates are going to rise. And basically, it means that the return that you're going to be getting on cash in 2 or 3 years' time is going to look much better than the return you're getting on cash now. So why are you going to buy a government bond that's yielding 2% or 1.5% when you could be getting more than 1.5% or 2% just on cash, which is totally risk-free in 2 or 3 years' time? And what they've been doing, what people have been doing with the money instead, hence the trade, is basically piling into stocks that look like they would either benefit from inflation or make money due to less regulation. So, as you said earlier, big rise in the banks, big rise in some of the energy companies and things like that.
Defense,
and it's like typical investment world trade, one-way traffic, dump that, buy that, jump on that bandwagon before that bandwagon rolls all the way out the door. Hence the Trumpflation trade.
Everything that Simon's just said there, kind of ignore that this is Donald Trump. Ignore if you can.
Sorry.
If you can. So I know, bear with me on this one. Ignore all that. With what you've read and what you've heard, is this workable?
I think that we need a lot of humility still to say that we don't know. That yes, you can kind of create a narrative through what he said and through the so far and in the campaign. You can create a narrative around whatever you like because he said so many different contradictory things.
True.
Whatever you want to believe, you can definitely make a very good case for. So within that, yes, there are scenarios in which it could be utterly workable. There does seem to be a lot of sense in this, as Simon says, this fiscal easing, this spending of money and reducing taxes so that people have more in their pockets to spend and there's generally more enterprise. Yes, that could be positive. As someone who believes in climate change, feel like regardless of how well it works in the short to medium term, if you're throwing everything out of the window that we've worked for until now, I mean, who cares that you've got a little bit more growth in the short term if it's going to have such a detrimental impact in the long term? And we really, you can read things for signs and you know, the symbols of what he says to the world leaders, who he meets first, what he says to them first, who he's getting
Japan,
in.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. And we were phoned, I think, 12th or something after places like New Zealand.
I think it was 10th. I think it was 10th. You know,
oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, okay, only 10th.
Yeah, I think it was 10th.
So you can read stuff into all of this, and that's what everyone's trying to do, trying to make some quick money out of working out what way things are going. But we don't know, and we won't know for a while. The other bloke's still in there till January.
That is the other one. Yeah, absolutely. Simon, I do want to ask you, though. I mean, we've said it many times on this show, the old saying that where America's economy leads, the rest of the world follows, hasn't really been necessarily so of late. But we did hear from the Fed chair, Janet Yellen, this week, of course, as I mentioned earlier, much criticised by Donald Trump, well, who wasn't, to be fair, but indicating an interest rate rise could be on the cards relatively soon. Markets expecting it even next month. But why, with all this uncertainty, when even she admits she has no idea what a Trump presidency will mean? Is this the right time for America? First, let's hear from Colin Chizinski, Chief Market Analyst at CMC Markets Toronto.
It's still the right time. The U.S. economy is still tracking in a good direction. And something she said that was quite important was she doesn't want the economy to get away on them either, that if the Fed waits too long, that then they may be forced to have to move more aggressively later, which could destabilize the economy. So at this point, she still feels they're better off move now and then just continue to raise interest rates gradually rather than wait too long. I think at this point you'd be looking primarily at economic data. The big ones coming up are at the beginning of the month. We'll get the U.S. non-farm payrolls and a similar data that comes out at the beginning of the month. And some of that could knock it off course, but at this point it would take a pretty negative surprise to do so. We're seeing signs of inflation pressures building a little bit in the United States. Employment remains strong. Retail sales has remained strong. So everything seems to be pointing to a very healthy U.S. economy at this point in time.
All right, then. So in that case, we're going to see an interest rate rise next month, perhaps. And will we follow suit, Simon?
Yeah, the interest rate thing is absolute genius because it's one of those classic things that shows just how wrong all the forecasts and the experts and all the predictions are. So basically, if Donald Trump was elected president, the exact opposite of this was supposed to happen. If Hillary was elected, we got an interest rate rise because Hillary represented more of the same. Safe pair of hands. We knew what we were going to get, which meant that because the American economy was doing okay, there wasn't the extra uncertainty of Donald Trump being in charge, the Fed could raise interest rates again, which they managed to do once last year in December. And then the expectation was they'd do another three or four times this year. And we've managed to get all the way to nearly the last month of the year and they haven't raised them again. So there's a lot of pressure on them to try and get another one out of the door. Mm-hmm. And if it was Hillary, that was totally fine. Trump, on the other hand, that was bad news. President Trump would mean that the stock market would crash. And when the stock market crashed, everyone would panic. And if we know one thing about the Fed, it likes the stock market not to crash.
Yep.
And so basically they wouldn't be able to raise interest rates because of all this uncertainty.
It's a bit like Brexit, wasn't it?
Yeah, a bit like Brexit. So we knew, we'd read the script, you know, Brexit, stock market down,
yep.
Cut rates, pretend you did the right thing for the wrong reasons, but it's still the right thing. So what happened? Well, the American stock market took a look at Donald Trump and it kept going up. It had already been going up for a few days, but it had started going up a few days before the election when everyone decided that Clinton was going to win. Because it had been going down when people thought Trump had a greater chance of winning. And you could see it. Basically, as Trump's chances of winning rose, market went down. As Trump's chances of winning fell, market went up. So everyone thought Hillary was going to win. Market goes up. Trump gets elected. Market's meant to fall, you know, some people were like 10, 15, 20%. Stock market just keeps going up. Hits a year high.
Are they suggesting it doesn't matter who's president?
So now the Fed's looking at this. Everyone's concerned about Trumpflation, and the Fed's looking at this and going, well, we're going to have to move because otherwise we're going to get all this inflation and otherwise we're going to have to raise rates too quickly in too short a time. And because the stock market hasn't fallen and everyone's not panicking, we can probably still raise rates in December. So there is now markets are talking a more than 95% chance that interest rates in the States are going up in December. So what does that mean for us in Brexit Britain? Well, doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to raise rates, but I mean, the interesting thing in the inflation report the other day was Mark Carney saying the next move could be up or down. Sounds very ambiguous, but previously it was expected the next move would be down. Also, if you've got this fiscal easing and you've got this slight turn away from low rates at the moment, criticism of central bankers and things like that, we're expecting maybe, you know, the government to start picking up a bit more of the burden of keeping the economy going and for central bankers to have to do a bit less. So I don't know. I think maybe, and as I said, you know, where the American economy leads, the rest of the world follows. But who knows what path it's going to take us down.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the Financial Website of the Year, fresh from another award. This is Money, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS9. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. While we have visited Trump in America, let's get a little closer to home, shall we? And what will come here? Borrowing, corporation tax, infrastructure spending, housing, stamp duty. We'll get a better indication on all those things and more next week, when the Chancellor gets his first opportunity to outline his priorities for taxes and spending. It is, of course, the autumn statement. Now, Mr. Hammond dropped his predecessor's plans, of course, to balance the books. So will he borrow more? That's despite warnings of a wee £100 billion black hole. Will the money go to roads, railways or housing? Could corporation tax be cut? Income tax threshold raised? Fuel duty frozen? Second home stamp duty scrapped? And indeed, what is the state of play with the economy at the moment? We, of course, got some numbers out this week, didn't we? Notably inflation, retail and unemployment. Inflation falling a smidge. Shops had a booming time of it, didn't they? And unemployment is at its lowest level in 14 years, something Conservative MP Damien Hines obviously rather pleased about.
We've got unemployment at a decade low of 4.8% and continuing that record high rate of employment. And we know there's more opportunities out there, still 750,000 vacancies. And of course, there's more to do. And we're working hard to make sure that more and more people can avail themselves of those opportunities as we build a society and economy that works for everybody in society. Income figures, the average wages increase on the year has been 2.4%, 1.7% after inflation, of course, with the introduction of the national living wage and firms continuing to create jobs and the continued high level of vacancies. I mean, this has been a good period in terms of wages.
Well, that was Damien Hines there, but inflation, a little bit of a surprise. Here's expert Peter Cumley.
I do think inflation is going to rise further. We already have those big increases in pipeline inflation pressures, largely due to the fall in the pound. And there are a few other things in the pipeline as well, including the reversal of the big falls in oil prices at the beginning of the year. So I think there's not much doubt that inflation is going to head for about 3% over the next year or so. The good news, though, is that that should be a temporary blip. I don't think that inflation is going to remain that high. I think it'll drop back again fairly quickly, back towards 1%. And one of the messages from today's numbers is that underlying inflation pressures in the economy are still pretty low. Very competitive high street in particular, but lots of other things going on that will keep, I think, underlying price pressures subdued.
Well, ever the optimist, Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, is warning the cost of living is still likely to rise. And yet, as Pete suggested, we're still heading out to the shops. Before we get those in more detail, Rachel, what is the autumn statement, firstly? What's the point of it?
This is a really good question. What is the point? I love it. but last year we had maybe three different statements. We had the budget, the autumn statement and an emergency budget, and lots of people are arguing that this is overkill. And I'd agree in the sense that a lot of policy is made up sort of, you know, just before a budget. We're seeing this now. It's always down to the wire on these things. And that's how you end up with ludicrous things like lifetime ISAs that aren't really thought through. So there is definitely a case to be made for going back to one a year, a bit more kind of consistency, and people can plan a bit better. Nonetheless, this one was announced ages ago, so it'll be the first statement that we've had really from the Chancellor since the Brexit vote. It's going to be a really interesting one. I've been excited about this one for a while.
I can sense it in the room, honestly. The tension is unbelievable. But is it really anything the Chancellor could and indeed should do?
Well, this is what's so interesting about it, is he really had a licence, I think, after Brexit to do things that the previous Chancellor couldn't. He could spend, he could say, do you know what, this is not the time to balance the books, we're going to try out some other things. He really had a lot of scope to do stuff. But as it's moved closer and closer towards this autumn statement, we've had a lot of very positive news coming out, as we've just heard. Inflation is not too bad yet. It's still below target, actually. We've still got record low unemployment. Consumer confidence is still high. People are still spending lots of money. So then the justification for doing things like spending a lot of money is sort of going out the window. It would be interesting to see what kind of line he treads. There have been stories in the last couple of days about him going around to think tanks saying, right, what we need to do is focus on these jams, they're calling them, the just about managings. Yeah. People who aren't really getting much support from the state but are still struggling, don't have enough for a rainy day if something goes wrong and really toughing it out at the moment. So what can we do for these people without spending any money or very little? And what we will see, I think, are things that sound pretty cool, but actually whatever.
But he doesn't have to balance the books, though, does he? His hands are slightly freed, aren't they?
He doesn't, but at the same time, we have seen a reduction in income from income tax. The receipts are lower. So actually, the deficit is getting bigger anyway, even if things are looking good on the surface and he's not spending any more. So his hands are still tied in that sense. Also, by far, the most revenues that we get are from income tax, national insurance and VAT, all of which the previous chancellor has promised not to touch. So he can't really go for any of those. And also, we've got all of these other promises that the chancellor made last time round about things like changing income tax brackets. So that's going to cost as well. So what can he do? One thing, potentially freeze fuel duty again. People always like that. Although at the same time, it's done so frequently that I wonder if it's sort of lost its impetus a little bit. There's been talk about cutting flight duties. But again, if this is to help families, well, kids are already exempt. I think it's more on sort of long haul flights anyway. So you wonder about who that really is going to be helping. He could go and announce a load of infrastructure projects. There's a really good argument for that. While the cost of borrowing is still low, why not go and do stuff? But then at the same time, well, employment is at record highs. So it's not like we're scrambling around looking for jobs at the moment for people. And there's a lot of talk about these, is it spade ready? Is some kind of funny term. But sort of projects that are ready to go, he just, signs it off and away we go. Well, there isn't really that much like that either. I mean, this house building, that'd be good. But there's so much red tape around that kind of stuff. It's really hard, I think, for him to make much of an impact for this group of people without spending any money.
Indeed, but is he the sort of person, maybe you mean impact in a different way, of course we got a lot of famous for it, wasn't he, Chancellor George Osborne, for those rabbits out of the hat moment, and maybe the idea of going back to, remember the glory days of the Autumn Statement, being about the health of the economy and the public finances, and maybe we just go back to a bit more steady as she goes, nothing really dramatic, Autumn Statement.
He could certainly justify that kind of thing at the moment, and you're right that is what people expect of him. He's seen as the accountant rather than the magician that Osborne imagined that he was. So yes, he could justify it, but then at the same time, we had straight after Brexit, we had a big announcement from Mark Carney. We're doing our bit from the monetary policy side of things. We're pumping all this imaginary money into the economy. We're cutting rates. It's over to you, Hammond. Do your thing. And you can't continue to have this pressure on central banks to mop it all up and do things when really their tools are very limited. What you have, which is a lot more nuanced, is fiscal policy, is messing around with taxes and spending and stuff like that. If we do want to see significant impact on the economy, on help for, I mean, we scoff at the term, but there's a real point to be made here about people who are just managing. If you want to do that, it's not up to central bankers, it's up to your chancellor. So he could do a sort of business as usual, but this is a real opportunity to change things.
Simon, over to you.
Yeah, I think there's two issues at play here. One is that there's that old joke, it's an old Irish joke, it's like, could you tell me how to get to here? And he says, well, I wouldn't start from here. And it's basically like, if you were going to do something spending to get the economy going and everything like that, you wouldn't start from here, whether you are the UK or the US. You wouldn't start from a point where you've already got so much debt. And this whole balancing the books exercise that we've been supposedly on in this country and, you know, around the world, certainly in this country, looks suspiciously like a New Year's diet and gym kind of promise where you basically last until about the 23rd of January and then you're like, oh, I'm done with that for the rest of the year. But then also I think there's the risk that we miss this golden opportunity of borrowing costs are super low. It's undeniable that the infrastructure of this country has suffered. Our roads are atrocious, absolutely atrocious, falling apart. As someone who cycles to work every day. I can tell you I see them at very close quarters and they are unbelievably bad. And that's the same outside of London as well as in London. Our railways aren't really that great. But it's also things like the schools and the hospitals. We've shut loads of hospitals. There's not enough schools. There's not enough secondary school places in a lot of very, very popular places. Transport isn't great, but we always seem to have to go for the big, grand project. We want to build High Speed 2 or we want to expand Heathrow. It's like these things take years, basically. Yeah. In the first 10 years of any plan to expand Heathrow or build a High Speed 2 rail link, in the first 10 years of that,
don't
the only people who get richer are lawyers, basically.
That's true.
And consultants. And I don't think that there has been a great concern expressed in this country over the past 9 years about whether lawyers and consultants are rich enough. The people that we're worried about is the man on the street, OK? It's that whole thing in the US, Wall Street versus Main Street. It's Main Street that we're worried about. So we need to do things to help them. You spend a load of money on fixing the roads properly. That puts money directly into the pockets of people who will then go out and spend that money. But also there's things like this big gap between, you know, metropolitan Britain, you know, certainly London and the southeast, but then also some of the other bigger cities. You know, Manchester is hugely successful at the moment. Mm. Birmingham is hugely successful at the moment. But then there's this gap between places like that and places up in the northeast or the northwest, which are really suffering. And how do we get more money flowing into them? How do we spread the wealth around a bit better? And I think some of those things that we need to tackle. One thing that has been suggested is that we might get these infrastructure bonds. So basically it would potentially be an investment open to the public where you could put your money into, you could lend your money to the government basically to go out and do something useful with, and the government in return would basically pay you an interest rate return. So, and it would be a bond, it would be an investment. But there is the element that if you did that and you offered people 3%, you'd probably be paying a little bit over the odds because you could borrow for less on the markets. You know, you could just issue gilts for less.
Yeah.
But you're paying a bit over the odds to your own taxpayers. So you're giving people a little bit more money. It makes them feel better. It's a virtuous thing. People get to invest in something. And I reckon if you said to the public, here you go, here's your bond, invest in this, 3%, and you're going to help make Britain great again, as Donald Trump would say.
Yeah, why don't they?
Well, they might do. They very well might do.
If you're listening, Chancellor, you've still got time. It's a few days.
But yeah, the jams thing, it's what do you do? The other thing there's a big push for at the moment is stamp duty.
Mm.
Cutting stamp duty. So the issue with stamp duty is George Osborne changed it from the old-fashioned slab-style system where once you went over a threshold, you paid the percentage on the whole amount, which was a very bad system, and he was right to change it. But what he also did is he made it more expensive for the top of the market. Now, everyone below £940,000 benefited, and most people don't buy houses more than £940,000. But even then, the problem was stamp duty had already got so high that by making it kind of neutral at those higher levels, it didn't get rid of the problem that stamp duty is still too high. And what you need is for people at the top, in order for a market to function properly, you need the people at the top of the market to be able to be moving and keeping things flowing as well. And you need lots of transactions. We don't have lots of transactions. And for people at the top of the market, it's ridiculously expensive. Like, feel sorry for my poor person living in their £800,000 home. But if they're living in an £800,000 home and they want to move to a place that's, you know, next step up, bit bigger or whatever, they're staring down the barrel of maybe £1 million, right? So they've got to raise another £200,000. Even the people living in £800,000 homes are going to really struggle to raise £200,000. So they're going to have to borrow a load more money on their mortgage, but there are limits to how much they can do that. How long is it going to, even if they saved half of that, how long is it going to take them to save up £100,000?
Yeah.
But then, on top of that, they're going to have to find more than £40,000 in stamp duty. If you're in that position, you're going to think very long and carefully about moving. And the last thing you're going to do is the thing that lots of people used to do in the past when the property market functioned properly, is move speculatively. Just think, I just fancy moving home. I'm going to move home. And it used to be that people did that. But the cost of moving is now so high, especially with the stamp duty burden, that you just wouldn't do that. Who'd drop £40,000 more than once? You'd be like, if I'm moving, I'm living there for the next 10 years. I'm not going anywhere.
And the reality is, well, we need people to move about. We need new homes. And we were hearing this week, weren't we, the number of homes for sale hit its lowest level in 40 years. Who is the hardest hit? Well, it's young people struggling the most. This is according to builder Taylor Wimpey. They're at the centre of a decline in home ownership. Share Radio senior analyst is Ed Bauscher.
These figures are pretty striking. They were bigger than I had expected, particularly for younger people. So looking at 25 to 34-year-olds, this survey says that almost 60% of people in that age group in 2003 owned their own home, and that has now fallen from 59% to 37%. So that is, you know, a dramatic fall, more than a third, and it really does underline the fact that younger people are really struggling to get on the housing ladder now, and that's completely understandable when house prices have got so high.
Well, the review blames low incomes amongst young people and their access to mortgages, the lack of supply also. Key, though, as Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors chief economist Simon Rubinson argues.
You can't ignore the supply side. What's clear from our survey, our latest survey, but actually if you look back for the last 2 years, the survey has been telling pretty much consistently a fairly similar story, is that there's not enough new property coming to the market so that any increase in buyer appetite quickly filters through into higher prices because they just can't find the stock they want to buy. So the imbalance between demand and supply driving up prices.
So, Rachel, your views on this, seeing so few homes come to the market, and then, of course, we're getting next year. I want to ask you as well, your ludicrous lifetime ISA intended to help people save either for retirement or a first home, but well, they've not got a home to buy, have they?
No, I've no idea how you would do it. In the last year, the average home has gone up by £16,000. Imagine if you have been saving diligently over the past year for a deposit for your first home. Oh, if you've put aside 16 grand, that's amazing. But the chances are you've got nowhere near that. Mm. And then how despondent must you feel when the prices just keep going up at that kind of pace around you? And this report this week from Rightmove points out that while we've got average price increases around that much, it's even worse if you want a sort of starter home. There's real pressure on sort of two-bed flats around that area of the market, so it's even tougher. Don't know how on earth you're going to do it. So the government has been doing all sorts of little tweaks, nudges, throwing money at buyers, or loosening up the terms of borrowing to make it easier for people to kind of, they give the Bank of England permission to do all sorts of things to make it tougher for people to borrow so that people don't overstretch themselves. But then they find these little gimmicky loopholes to help first-time buyers around it. Some of them are expiring this year. Some of them are still going. All sorts of help to buy things and help to buy ISA and lifetime ISA are the latest little tricks we've
Remind
seen.
Us what they are, the lifetime ISA, if you
The
would.
Lifetime ISA is
I hear the sigh in your voice.
Yeah, yeah, it's a savings account that you can put money in and the government tops it up with another 25%, which is pretty cool. The condition is that you have to spend it either on your first home or you can take it out at age 55, as they say now. Who knows when you come to retire?
And
when
you have to be under 40, right?
You have to be under 40. Yeah. Or you can take it out for and use it as a pension.
Two incredibly similar things to save for, I imagine.
Well,
not really.
Well, so that's the problem, is that really you've got to have a pension. I mean, it's great if you've got a home to live in. That's really cool if you can retire and not have to pay rent. That is wonderful. But if you've got no pension, you're in trouble. And it kind of does send confusing messages, I think, about the interchangeable nature of those two things. And also the fear that people have really about these lifetime ISAs is that people will think, oh, that sounds jolly, and put all their money in that rather than putting it into what most people have access to, which is a pension from their employer.
And you forgo that money that the employer would,
right?
Which
is free money.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that is the fear. The other fear is if you take your money out prematurely from one of these accounts, then you're really heavily fined in a way that no one in the private sector would be able to get away with.
We have an article on your website about this, about how, yes, indeed, there's mis-selling, but also about the fact that people won't know how to use it properly. They'll take it out, they'll get hit with big fines. Simon, your view?
I have three big concerns over the lifetime ISA. Right, my first concern is that people will put their money into this because they think, well, I would need to save for a home and I also need to save for retirement. This is the easy option. But by doing this and taking this, they will get the 25% bonus, which is basically the equivalent of tax relief, basic rate tax relief on your pension. But what they will miss out on if they don't take their pension instead from their work is they will miss out on their employer's contributions. And your employer's contributions are essentially a wonderful thing, because if they'll match what you put in, that means you've got twice as much money going in there as you would otherwise have. And you're not going to have that with the lifetime ISA. Maybe it can be tweaked. There's talk about tweaking it to allow employer contributions, but the way it's set up at the moment, that won't happen. My second concern is that basically what will happen with the lifetime ISA is what we've seen with junior ISAs and what we've seen in other places, is that people will put, they'll go for the cash option rather than the investment option. Now, realistically, if you're putting money aside for your pension, you need to be investing it because you've got the long-term power of the stock market to deliver returns. Long-term real return on the stock market is 5%. So that's the return above inflation. Even if you look at a lower growth world, long-term real return, went to a talk this week by Professor Elroy Dimpson, who's a senior finance kind of bod. He said, looking forward, 3% a year real return. But that compounds up really nicely, you know, over a long period. Whereas cash, the real return is about 1%. So there's a big difference between those two things. And if you measure it over 30 years, 40 years, there's a really big difference there. So actually, you need to be investing that money, not putting it into cash. And too many people will just simply choose cash because they're worried about investing and they don't invest anyway. And we know that's what people do. It's just simple.
It's a reality isn't it?
It's just simple reality. It's behaviour. We've observed it behaviourally. Then the third issue is that even if you do invest, right, and this is one of the things that the FCA said this week, and they're going to slap a load of warnings all over this thing.
When they warn tougher safeguards, don't they?
Is that basically, should you be investing for both your retirement and your house purchase? Because those are two quite different things. Like, the house purchase is probably a relatively short-term element. You might be putting that money aside for less than 5 years' time. So there's a question as to whether you should be investing that in the first place. Mm. You certainly probably want to be investing that with a very different style and a lot more caution if you're age 30 and you want that money in 5 years' time for your house than you would be if you're age 30 and you want that money in 40 years' time for your pension, when you can afford to take a lot more risk because you've got time and compounding on your side. So those are my three big concerns about the lifetime ISA. And because of those, it just looks a little bit like an accident waiting to happen, or something that won't have the desired effect that it's meant to have. Because the aim is noble, but I think we're mixing two things together that don't need to be mixed together.
Right. Well, let's put that to one side for now and focus on something else. For model Linda Evangelista, it was $10,000. She wouldn't wake up for anything less. I'm far cheaper. It's just a cup of coffee for me. But actually, OK, it's not $10,000, but it's not cheap. And I'm paying more than in other areas. London, we're hearing, is the most expensive city in the UK for coffee, with the average cup costing £1.62. I think I'm being robbed. I don't pay anywhere near that. But like much of the recent food price inflation, the weak pound has been blamed for higher import costs. Is that true? Can we blame Brexit? Why are we looking at how expensive coffee is around the country, Rachel?
Just because there's such disparity, I think, between what you can get here. And also, in the same story, we've got a comparison globally. And
how do we match up?
Yeah, it's pretty rubbish, really. But then the cost of living is much higher here, so maybe it's OK. I was in Mumbai last month, and I have to admit, I went into Starbucks. Mm-hmm. Cost the same.
Ooh.
And the cost of living is far lower in India. That we talk about things like the Big Mac Index. You can compare sort of the cost of living in different countries around the world by the price of the Big Mac, because it's sort of kept relative. The price of a Big Mac is kept relative, you know, the same proportion to the cost of living around the country.
But it clearly wasn't targeted at locals. It was targeted
at Starbucks.
You. Yeah.
Well, no.
No?
It was, I mean, it was a different market. It wasn't just me. It was sort of,
That'd be good, though, if they did open a store just for you, for your holiday to India.
Generally, people in Mumbai who are wealthier, it's not like Big Macs.
I think when you look at these Costa cups of coffee around the world, it also reflects the coffee drinking nations themselves. So, for example, in Milan, it'll cost you £1.28. If you're in Spain, in Seville, it'll cost you £1.29. If you're in Valencia, it'll cost you £1.33. Those are the countries where traditionally coffee is a big thing. You know, you go for a coffee. So you expect it. It's just part of your daily norm. It's not a luxury.
Yeah.
But then you've got somewhere like France, in Paris, where, again, coffee is part of your daily norm. But you won't be surprised to find that coffee in Paris is expensive at £2.13. Now,
£2.13?
Tell me Tell me anyone who's been to Paris and managed to get themselves a coffee in a cafe for £2.13 recently. And wow, that's impressive. I think you're looking more about €4. But I think the thing about this is...
€4 for a cup of coffee. I pay a lot for my coffee, shamefully so, but €4?
Yeah.
I've not been to Paris in a while.
I think that one of the things about coffee is, as a coffee drinker, okay, I'm not some hipster coffee snob, okay, obsessed with, like, you know, the beans and everything like that kind of thing. Find myself some slightly industrial looking place to sit down and drink my coffee and do my work on my MacBook. But I do like a decent cup of coffee. And by that, I mean proper coffee. Okay. I think the last time I drank instant coffee was maybe my late teens. And coffee, you know, you need to have proper coffee. I used to work in a bar in France. I had a coffee machine there. It was great. You know, that was it for me from that point on. Coffee by that, coffee in a cafetiere, coffee using a mocha pot on top of the stove.
Yeah.
That's all proper coffee. But it's got a lot easier to get a proper cup of coffee in this country over the last decade. And by a proper cup of coffee, I do not mean a bucket of milk from Starbucks with a small amount of coffee in the bottom.
Soy milk,
certainly,
obviously.
Certainly, Starbucks and Costa are very guilty of that. And that's when you order the smallest size cup. I mean, when you order the bigger cups, you are literally you're just ordering warm milk, warm flavoured milk. But, you know, a smaller cup, a flat white or something like that, a proper amount of cup of coffee in it, you can pretty much go to any town or even village in the UK now, and you can find yourself a proper cup of coffee, a decent cup of coffee. And I tell you what, you could not do that 10 years ago.
I can tell you from personal experience, Simon, I used to work at one of the famous brands back when I was a wee younger lady. But we, in our instruction, we actually went to coffee school for this. We had to, I know it's ridiculous. We had to explain to the customers that came in, to be fair, it was on a motorway service station, that when they asked for an espresso, do they really mean the short one, or do they actually mean a cup of coffee? And you think we were being patronising. This was probably about 15 years ago. We weren't. The majority, they just went for the cheapest option. So I just, you know, I did my job there in educating the public about coffee and how that has changed now. But let's move on from that, because they always say, don't they? Look, if you cut out that daily cup of coffee, and I mentioned how much I spend on coffee, you can focus on the bigger purchases, you know, maybe getting that deposit. And they don't get much bigger, though, than a Ferrari or a McLaren, either way. What about two supercars, a McLaren and a Ferrari, his and hers, no less, for a combined £700,000 on This Is Money's website. You've been covering this. And actually, I've done a little bit of maths here, Simon, so it's quite plausibly wrong. £1.62 a day on coffee, that's £589 a year. It will take me 1,187 years to save up for the his and hers Ferrari. I've got to find myself a better his if I'm going to get that car, to be honest. But Simon, it sounds very footballery to me. What's going on here?
It does sound a bit footballery, doesn't it? So what we have here is, and Rob Hull, our motoring reporter, wrote about this earlier this week. It's a pair of supercars.
Right.
And they're not really just supercars. They're kind of hypercars, really. So a Ferrari 458 Speciale and a McLaren 675 LT. Now, these are in matching white paint. And they are being sold strictly as a pair. You cannot buy these individually.
So romantic, isn't it?
Yeah, so £699,000 and you've got to buy both of them. Now, these are...
Why? Why? What's the point of that? Who gets the McLaren, who gets the Ferrari?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't have to be his and hers.
And let's be inclusive. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Could be his
and his. Hers and hers, absolutely.
Or you could just be the kind of person who wants two for yourself.
Yeah, in case you break one.
Yeah, exactly. Or you, if you... I mean, the thing is, if you're spending £300,000 on a car, you're going to be probably quite rich and quite into your cars. So you might think that actually, hey, why don't I get two of these things?
Bargain.
And the dealer, basically, Essex dealer Alistair Bowles, the UK's leading independent McLaren specialist, basically struck a deal with the owner of these two cars and said, well, no, we'll only sell them together. Brilliantly, these two white supercars are being sold by a dealer in Essex, which, you know, stereotypes and all that.
I'm saying nothing about
that.
But
basically, the Ferrari has got less than 1,600 miles on the clock. The McLaren has got 292 miles on the clock. Basically, these are the kind of cars that you're not going to drive much. Or if you do drive them, you're going to knock down the value. You only drive them on special occasions. I hope that they do go to someone who drives them, because cars are meant to be driven. But I tell you, if you buy them, they'll probably go up in value.
So a good investment, you reckon?
They might actually be a good investment. They're very rare cars. They're considered to be very special cars. And cars like this have, and past performance is no guide to future returns, cars like this have been rising in value in recent years, and there is an entire little niche of people who buy supercars. They own them for 3 or 4 years, they use them and they sell them, and they've basically made enough money on that car. It's gone up in value, even though it's a new car, it's gone up in value. They've made enough money on that car to basically pay the whole of the cost of ownership over those 3 or 4 years. That, however, is a big gamble, because prices don't always go up. Prices are high at the moment. They could go down. And if you get that wrong, the cost of ownership over 3 or 4 years is going to run into tens of thousands of pounds.
But you got yourself a couple of decent cars.
Oh, yeah, and you need 700 grand in the first place.
Yeah, not very romantic, though, if you think of it like that.
My wife would be delighted if I brought home a Ferrari and a McLaren, to be perfectly honest. Although she doesn't
until like, she checks the bank balance.
She doesn't like white cars, so she wouldn't want these two. She'd probably turn them down.
Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.